Hello and welcome to The Stack. And what a great show we have in store. We speak with the new executive editor for Fortune magazine, plus Melinda Stevens on her new book with Assouline. And finally, a look back at the influential German magazine, Twen. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start the show welcoming back Alex Wood Morton. This time he joins us as a guest to talk about his new role as executive editor for Fortune magazine. The title is undergoing a big editorial expansion in Europe. Alex joins us in the studio to talk about the plans, their new lists, and a special magazine cover for the European edition.
So 94 years of history, a real iconic brand from the United States. Many people will know the Fortune 500, the listing of the highest revenue generating businesses in the world. But what I'm here for at Fortune is a big expansion in Europe. It's a real honor, you know, when you take on a brand that is that old and they trust you to grow it. And also, most importantly, make it really serve a European audience. That's really my focus.
Has Europe always been an important market for Fortune, or how does it work? Do you have a specific edition here for Europe?
So speaking to the print edition, yes, we do. And speaking as a longtime lover and fan of print magazines, I was so excited when hearing about this opportunity to be able to take on a print magazine. Even though I'm 38 years, I'm going to say young, I've had some opportunities to work in print in my career, in my previous place at Forbes, and I actually launched a print magazine back in 2013. I think once it gets into your blood, you could never really lose that joy and that excitement about print and the tangible and the production of it. So yes, European edition has existed for a number of years. But really, it's been very heavily mirrored to the US edition. And so what this investment, this expansion in Fortune in Europe is really about is giving us the freedom and the creativity to really think about what matters to European readers. So I'm looking at cover stars. And you know what? When I speak about cover stars, and I think you would be a really good person to ask about this, actually, it's really challenging because here I am in London editing this edition and I'm looking for the right face. You know, I want to make an impact as an editor, but it's actually really hard when you think about it as pan-European. How do you find a face that has cut through? It's easy to find like a UK-based business person, but do they know them in Paris? Do they know them in Oslo? It's really, really challenging. So that's something that if any of your listeners or you can help me with, I'd be grateful for the help.
I mean, yeah, it's certainly quite challenging, you know, it's something that is quite uniting in a way. But I've read, I believe your newsletter was interesting talking about European coverage as well, that one of the things you've mentioned, not only regulation, but how those iconic brands here in Europe, how they are having to, you know, adapt to this modern world and sometimes with success. And I think that's definitely one of the areas you guys are planning to cover, right?
Absolutely. I think one great example to share with you that's very front of mind for me editorial at the moment is when you think about huge brands like LVMH and you think about Bernard Arnault, my attention is actually going on the next generation. I'm thinking about Alexander Arnault. I'm thinking about Frederick Arnault, his children, and many of the others as well, because when you watch what they're doing with brands like Rimowa, with brands like Tag Heuer and Tiffany, I'm really excited to see, you know, these younger members of the family are millennials. They are coming from a different generation, a digital first generation. They're playing with NFTs. They're doing collaborations with brands like Supreme. And I think that's really exciting for Europe. You know, I'm not going to pretend, as I wrote in my editor's note today, and it's also in my editor's note for the first print edition, we can't sugarcoat it. Europe is not the economically strongest part of the world. You know, let's not pretend that the data is there. But actually, there are brands. There's history. And I'm curious about where those brands are going.
Well, and it's a very, you know, well-read continent. And I'm sure they will be interested in a title like Fortune as well. Tell us, where, for example, do you have newsrooms in Europe? Where are you planning to grow? I know the UK is definitely one of those countries.
Absolutely. We have our bureau in London, and our managing director was telling me actually that we are about to move office for the fifth time because we have been expanding so fast. We are running out of space, and one honor and a privileged to say that in this current media market. I know many of my colleagues out there are really suffering in this market. And then across Europe at the moment, we have people working out of cities at the moment. We don't have physical bases within our family, but we have people sat in Geneva. We have people in Madrid, Paris, and also two people in Berlin. So we're covering those major cities, but my team has already learnt this about me, and I think it aligns with Monocle as well, that I make no secret of my passion for the Nordics. So I'm hoping we can really expand there as well.
I mean, they are, especially economically, right? Mm. They have some incredible companies there. What about the print edition? I know, of course, digital is very important, but I know you're a fan of printed editions as well.
Yes.
Your very first one as executive editor is coming out very soon.
Yes.
What can we expect? I mean, can you give us a preview? Of course, maybe, I don't know if you want to review the cover or not.
What can I tell you? So I'll be very transparent with you that I'm coming into this role to build a digital newsroom as well as a print edition. It's very foundational at the moment. We are scaling rapidly in terms of digital content. And what I'm doing with the print magazine is I'm slowly ramping up stage by stage with each edition across this year and taking over more and more control. I'm in a very, I guess, quite uniquely privileged position that there is an incredible team in the US and also many of the writers they work with in Europe who are producing fabulous content. And I have the wonderful, not many editors have this privilege of kind of picking the bits I want and not picking the bits. They're already laid, they're already edited. So at the moment, it's going to be gradual, but what can I say? Well, maybe something interesting in terms of my choice of cover. I won't say too much because I don't want to reveal things that my US colleagues have done all the hard work and then they find out I let them go. But what I will say is the distribution of the magazine is interesting and it influenced my choice for the first cover for Europe, which will be unique to the US edition. And that is that we are leaning heavily into business class lounges. We are doing newsstand as well. But when you think about the kind of Fortune reader, that CEO executive level, it makes sense. So we're focusing London Heathrow, Geneva, Milan, et cetera, et cetera. And so let's just say that my choice of cover is very much aligned with the people that are there and what they're about to get onto.
Talking about lounges as well, I think it's good to have a magazine there, mm-hmm. a title like Fortune. I think especially in this post-pandemic world, they sometimes forgot that actually how important yep. the magazines are in the lounges.
I mean, you know, my although it's not in lounges, I pay the cover price. My go-to is Monocle when I get onto a plane, actually. It's a fabulous thing to read on a plane.
What about new lists? I mean, sorry if you have that already, but a Fortune 500 Europe? That
yes,
could be...
so I know we're on radio and people can't see, but in front yes. of you, I have a copy of the first Fortune Europe 500 list that came out in November last year. And this will continue every single year. It's really interesting and it leans again into print. It might sound a bit sort of contrarian, but actually people get really excited to see a list in print and they do want to kind of flick through the pages.
I love lists.
Yes, exactly. And already we are looking at how we can expand that because what's different in Europe compared to the US is many of those companies, the most highest revenue generating companies, are privately held, very different to the US. And so we're looking at how can we lean into that. But you speak of lists. I think one of the most interesting examples we've had even in, this is month one for me, we launched one for International Women's Day. And this is one thing I really want to stress that I think is unusual and I'm really happy about our organization in Europe. We have an economist in our office, a lady called Greta Scheppers, and she came from Fidelity. She has a long history in the heart of the city of London. It's not often you get that in a newsroom. And so what she did for International Women's Day is she took most powerful women's list, sliced all the Europeans from there. And then she also took all the female CEOs from that Fortune 500 Europe list that you have in front of you, fused them together. And we found something, and I think this really speaks to how we're being different. We found a really interesting trend. The majority of those women on that list were over the age of 55.
Right.
Now, what do you read from that? Do we celebrate that? Yes, it's amazing that success has no limits, but also, like, does it mean you have to wait till you're 55 to be a female CEO in Europe? And it was really nice for us to be able to explore those things and turn it into a piece of analysis and also a rallying call for more change in the sector. And I'm really proud of all the reporters as well that got to work on our first list.
Thank you very much, Alex. And the new issue of Fortune Europe is out this coming Monday and in the US on the 23rd of April. And now it's time to welcome back another former guest here, Melinda Stevens, former editor of Condé Nast Traveler, and now founder and creative director of creative agency Salt Lick. She's also a writer for Asuline's new book, Secret Stays, pioneering hosts of the new chic. She dropped by Midori House.
I've literally just launched my creative agency over the last few months. I've been doing work for different people, and yesterday I launched my website for it. So it's called Salt Lick Creative, and I'm very excited.
And of course, travel still plays a big part in your life, right, in general?
I mean, I think travel is playing such a big part in everyone's lives. Like, wherever I go now, it feels to me like people are in whatever kind of credit crunch crisis there is, they're going to spend their last pennies on being out in the world and experiencing the world and eating and feasting and dancing and absorbing different cultures. I think it's become even more important.
And the way we travel is different. And I think your book, Secret Stays, reflects that, right? We want more than just a simple hotel. There's something extra, right? So tell us a bit more about the concept of the book.
I was talking to Martine Asseline about doing a new book with them, and I think Martine was pretty focused on doing a new hotel book. We'd done a previous book with them called Chic Stays, and I wanted to point her in the direction of something that I had witnessed more recently that I thought was a really interesting evolution. And I think that's really been born out of Airbnb. So in the beginning, when Airbnb launched in the noughties, I mean, it was, you know, it was such an improbable thing to start off with, that you would go and, you know, stay in someone's tiny room in Copenhagen or some dusty old cupboard in wherever it was. But as that proposition evolved, it was interesting to me to note that really interesting, previously totally inaccessible places and castles and riads had a shift in attitude too. And that, of course, came out for a number of reasons. One was the reality that owning a big castle or lodge is extremely costly, and that perhaps there were more, you know, viable revenue streams that could come off, you know, opening rooms. Secondly, also, I think it was a younger generation had often moved into the sphere and were less self-conscious and more generous-spirited. They understood more that actually being open-armed was a different cultural reality. And thirdly, what that's meant is that around the world, that's kind of caught on. Everyone has, you know, now following everyone else and not being scared of doing it. And that layered on top of that, a lot of the places in the book are people who've just taken on old ruins or dilapidated, abandoned places and then poured their blood and sweat and tears into it. So, yeah, it makes for this really remarkable collection of very specific, individual, unique places to stay.
And it's not just the place sometimes, it's the sense of hosting as well, right? I mean, to host well, it's a place that is quite personalized almost in a way, right?
Totally. I talk a lot about what a terrible host I am. My husband calls me
I don't think you. I have a feeling you're not, but
my husband says I'm very style over substance and I'm a terrible cook and I forget all the important things, but I do love having people into my house and making them feel welcome, and I love it when they pour around and look at photos and look at the pictures that I've collected over the years. But I think these hosts, the hosts that we have focused on in this book, are a cut above because, and without sounding too kind of pretentious or too earnest, I think what they understand is that, yeah, that true nature of hospitality. And I'm always very drawn to it and warm to it when I see it and I witness it when I'm part of it. And I think it goes way, way, way back in time to when strangers would travel across, you know, lands and you would be welcomed in and provided rest and you would break bread and you would exchange stories of your different, you know, of the different places where you lived, and then those strangers would depart the next day and something profound had happened, a kind of a shift. And I think that the hosts we talk about in these places understand the potency and the power and the generosity of spirit of doing that. Not, you know, it's not about bottom lines, really. Mm. These guys are not really, they're not doing it to make, you know, vast quantities of money, or, you know, it's not about the P&L. It's about generosity of heart and of spirit and of sharing.
And there's so many interesting places in the books, very hard to choose. But, you know, you go from the Baffin Estates in Romania to this wonderful villa in Tangier as well. I wonder, of course, we're not going to have time to talk about all of them. Is there any one that is special to you? I'm sure all of them are special. But give us a little taster about one of them.
Well, funny enough, I was just flicking through the book before I came in here, and we had the launch party last night. And Jasper Conran, who owns that mm-hmm. villa in Tangier that you're mentioning about, he was wearing, oh my gosh, he's so stylish. He was wearing a kind of lime green shirt with a lime green coat, wow. with a the rest of us would not be able to get away with this, with some kind of blue, a sky blue moment going on around his neck here. And I realized just looking at the book now that lime green is the same color that he has on his sun loungers around his pool. So I think it's pertinent to the villa. And I just had some friends who came back from there who said it was beyond beautiful. It was the villa owned by Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Berger. It had then they'd kind of abandoned for quite a long time. And I think Jasper had gone to Tangier to buy a tent, and he ended up falling in love with this. And I think he spent many years patiently, lovingly, tenderly and thoughtfully reinstating and reinvigorating this villa.
Oh, it's a beautiful one. And one thing very random, but I liked your, well, may I say editor's letter in a way? And that's what I've missed from when you were editor of Condé Nast Traveler. That was always one of my favorite parts. Tell us actually about it, because you mentioned a place you were, what's the name? Bolton Abbey in Yorkshire, right?
So this was the experience that kicked off the book for me. I was staying with my friends Nikki and Jazzy Dunn, and this hall is next to an abbey in Yorkshire, and it's a beautiful kind of shooting lodge, and the original part of the building and decoration hasn't been touched, but they had just redecorated the wing where their guests would stay, and it was done really beautifully by Rita Koenig and Laura Burlington, and I always get, I'm a sucker for the details, and they had those, you know, when you go into a place and you have like a padded, but it's not a crazy cell, a padded wall, when there's a material on top of it and it has a kind of certain pad and squish. I've always loved that. And Rita and Laura had done this on the floor. There were this beautiful tartan carpets that were all squishy underneath. Anyway, I fell madly in love with those. And this is now a property that you can rent out in its entirety for exclusive use. And that really was the bolt that made me realise this property is owned by the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire, who also own Chatsworth. So here was this new thing of this new generation opening themselves up and putting themselves, you know, out in the fray. And suddenly it was, you know, possible for others to participate in and experience these very special places.
Melinda, where, well, you don't need to tell me exactly, but where do you travel these days? Are places like in the book? Are you the kind of person that if you were not editing, perhaps you would be inspired? Is that your type of travel these days?
I've always loved adventures. In fact, on Monday, I'm off to the Galapagos.
Amazing.
With my lovely extended family. My stepmother is a big, inspiring traveller to me. She would always take us from when we were kids to the most extraordinary places. My gosh, we went to a lot of ruins. I didn't appreciate it then. I appreciate it now. And, you know, all of these very precious places, I think the Galapagos, there's rumours around them closing it off to visitors mm-hmm. because of the over-tourism. And over-tourism is something I'm completely and utterly obsessed by. And that's why anyone who's cutting their own path and doing something bold and brave in a more unexpected way is very inspiring to me. There's, yeah, as you mentioned, you know, the Bethlen Estates in Transylvania, that was just owned by a family for many generations, but it was a completely ruined collection of tumbled down, you know, properties, but that family is now back there. And I think that's about, it's about roots and it's about legacy and it's about reinvigoration. And I think I talk a lot about, you know, the specifics of place. What makes places different, not the same. And there's a lot of people travelling along the same paths, like little sheep, or one after the other. And I'm applauding the people who do things differently.
That's fantastic. It's a great book, Secret Stays. And perhaps, Melinda, I'm just curious as well, because I know you've been editing Belmont's kind of travel magazine, which I thought it was a thing of beauty. I had a look at the previous one, right? It's an annual title. What can you tell us, actually, briefly about it?
Oh, it's such a happy project. Monde, we call it a global compass on modern culture. It comes out annually. It's big format. It doesn't have to behave like normal magazines because we don't need to sell to advertisers and we are not pressured by what you put on the cover because of newsstand. So it has incredible freedom and kind of liberation away from the normal parameters of perhaps working in more legacy media. And there's an amazing team who works on it. And we focus and continue to focus on young, talented photographers with really specific lenses. And we utilize a lot of my old Condé Nast Traveler staff, whose network from a writer's and storytelling point of view is unmatched. And it's this really beautiful proposition that makes me creatively very satisfied.
Thank you, Melinda. Always a great chat with you. And Secret Stays, published by Asseline, is out now. And finally on the show, a fascinating new book delving into the history of the influential German magazine Twan, which was published from April 1959 to May 1971. I had the pleasure to find out more about the magazine with two of the writers in the book, French art director Serge Gico and French design educator Stéphane Daricot.
If you have to keep one magazine in the world, in the history of the culture of magazine, I think it would be Twan. Because it was the beginning of the 60s. And I think in the 60s, it was the golden age of the magazine culture.
And Stéphane, golden age, and in Europe, I would say especially, because it was the kind of the post-war vibes after, you know, decades of tragedy. I think it was kind of a showcasing a new phase for the continent as well, right?
Yes, but it's an interesting story because actually, the magazine format started in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century with especially German illustrated magazines. And then it crossed the Atlantic, become this huge model with very powerful American newspaper groups. And then it came back in Europe with a huge influence of what was happening in the US. For instance, the British Picture Post was founded with Life magazine as a model, but the model of Life magazine were German magazines from the beginning of the 20th century. So it's some kind of transatlantic dialogue when it comes to magazines. And obviously, Twan is a very good example because it's thoroughly German and very oriented towards German youth of the time, but it had lots of influences coming from the United States because Willy Fleckhaus, the art director, was a huge admirer of what was happening in the US at the time.
And Serge, I was wondering, what was kind of the content of the magazine? You know, we know a lot about the visual iconic, which we can talk about it later. But was it kind of a cultural title? Was there a little bit of politics too?
Maybe it was an Instagram on print. You have a car, a business car, you have sexuality, you have many topics about the young people from Germany and maybe in the world. You had the same magazine in UK, it was Nova and Men of Baton. It's the reason why I say it was a golden age. You have Elle in Paris, you have Nova and Turn in London. And it was the best magazine in those days. You have an example, Harry Piccinotti was art director for Twan in the holiday of Willy Fleckhaus. And you have also Willow Kids, a great art director of Look magazine, US. And he found two of Twan and maybe 2 weeks after he was in Germany to learn layout with Willy Fleckhaus.
And I mean, Willy Fleckhaus, I mean, he, I think perhaps was you that described Serge as the Miles Davis of magazine design, right?
Yeah, the funny thing, you have also with Men of Baton, designed by Tom Woolsey. He was also German. He was Jew-German. I think maybe the roots of magazine, it was born in Germany. And even the World magazine born in UK with a Gentleman magazine.
Stefan, a question. With a magazine like Etvan, which finished in 1971, I think they tried to kind of get it back, but it did somehow it didn't work. Do you see the influence of that title still today?
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, actually, Serge,
you, Monocle.
Oh yes, good, very good.
Black cover magazine.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and Serge will correct me there if I'm wrong, but I think that every magazine art director today who has at least a little bit of knowledge of its own craft has Twain as a model and Vidi Fleckhaus as a mentor. It's as pervasive as that, actually. It's everywhere. Francesco Franchi in Italy, Matt Willey in Britain and then the US. Everyone thinks that Fleckhaus basically invented the game.
Well, and I am flicking through the book now because besides the lovely text by both of you and a third contributor, the imagery, I mean, it is fantastic. And Serge, you mentioned the black background on the covers. I mean, that was quite revolutionary at the time, right?
Yeah, totally. Because imagine a world now, you have your editor-in-chief and I want to make a cover with a black background with a cut of the face. I'm sure everyone say, oh no, it's impossible. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Forget it. But Willy Fleckhaus did it in the 60s. It was a revolutionary mind, I think.
And Stefan, what can you tell us in terms of the typography, which I know, you know, that's kind of your expertise. What did Etvan do in a special way about that?
Fleckhaus was really clever when it came to establishing the visual identity of the magazine. So he aped basically this Swiss lettering style and made it the main titling font in Twain and use it in a very expressive and spectacular way. And so basically that's the main gist of my contribution. He made this specific alphabet. He made other designers, art director, want to use this specific alphabet. And so you can find it basically everywhere during the 60s and not only in Switzerland where it was born. And then having established the identity of Twain in a very powerful, assertive way, then in the second half of the 60s, basically, Fleckhaus started to loosen up a bit and use other kinds of typefaces. But basically, Twain, the idea, the visual idea that we have of Twain is basically Schmalfeld Grotesque, this specific font that Fleckhaus made his own.
Serge, I have a question. I mean, during the research for the book, I'm sure you looked at archives, at old copies. Did you speak with perhaps some of the people that worked there? Why do you think it didn't really manage to return as a magazine? Why did it finish? It had a fairly, you know, short lifespan for a magazine.
I think it's Daniel Philippaki says the magazine born, lives and died. And I think even the good magazine can die.
I agree. I mean, there's been so many titles I've missed. Do you keep old copies with you as well, Serge? Do you have it? I mean,
yes, it's a long research. I think I have only 4 issues missing now.
Do you have it as well, Stefan?
Oh, no. I'm not much of a collector.
I am the crazy man, not Stefan.
Yeah, he's the crazy one. And basically, that's because we knew each other. We have been knowing each other for quite a long time now. And I knew that he had this huge collection with vintage artifacts and authentic issues of that. I contacted Serge and said, oh, we should make a book about that. Because obviously, we've got all the material. And we can work from that and make, let's say, the first French language book devoted to Twain and Vidi Fleckhaus. So we drew a lot upon Serge's collection in there.
I think, Fernando, it's the problem when you are a lover of magazine, you need space and for the archives always. And maybe if we can resume the book, It's like a perfume with the essence of Twain.
Thank you, Serge and Stéphane. And Twain, 1959-1971, is out now, published by Bureau Brut Publishing. And that's it for this week's show. My thanks, as ever, to our editor, Jack Jewers. Any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. We're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Meanwhile, you can listen to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. It's goodbye from me. Thank you.